In this stadium in Rwanda's capital, Kigali, thousands of people once hid from an ethnic slaughter. Rwandans have come to remember and watch a symbolic reenactment of the genocide 20 years ago. The ceremony is presided over by Rwanda's president, Paul Kagame.
We did not need to experience genocide to become a better people. It simply should never have happened.
That's from a BBC documentary, Rwanda's Untold Story, about the horrific genocide in that country two decades ago. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. What is genocide? Who commits it? Why and how? What can be done to stop the kind of large-scale, calculated slaughter of civilians that we've seen in Armenia, Nazi Germany, Rwanda, Bosnia, Somalia, and many other countries? Joining me to discuss preventing genocide is a man who in an earlier part of his career served as a journalist covering the genocide in Rwanda. Scott Strauss is now a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the author of numerous books, including Making and Unmaking Nations, War, Leadership, and Genocide in Modern Africa, and Fundamentals of Genocide and Mass Atrocity Prevention, a book published in 2016 by the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. Welcome to University of the Year.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start by talking about your own journey to this topic of genocide.
So my journey, it's very accidental. I mean, I was a journalist outside of college, and I was became a freelance journalist and was based in Nairobi, Kenya. And I developed some relationships with editors, and then there was a genocide in Rwanda, and that was followed ultimately by a coup in Burundi, in the neighboring country Burundi, and then a big war on the borders of Rwanda in the country now known as the Democratic Republic of Congo. And basically, when I started as a reporter and I went to Africa, my agenda was to kind of tell the sides of Africa that people weren't hearing, you know, about the sort of normal everyday politics, about people's lives and that kind of thing. But as I developed relationships with editors, they pulled me into these war stories. And so I was, you know, sent to cover basically war on the edges of Rwanda. And there I covered that war for about a year, and I witnessed sort of horrific massacres, mass movements of people, and got turned on to the story of what happened in Rwanda in 1994. And, essentially in Rwanda in 1994, in the genocide, there were at least 500,000, probably closer to 600,000 or 700,000 civilians killed in 3 months. And even though that had happened, I knew very little about it, and there had been relatively little reporting about it. And that really started for me a kind of curiosity about, you know, why do these things happen? What happened in Rwanda? How can we know what happened? And eventually that led me back to graduate school. I got a degree in political science at Berkeley. And since then, I've really been, you know, really kind of scratching my head over trying to understand, you know, how these kinds of horrific episodes of mass violence can occur.
Doesn't it take a toll on you? Because I have to say that, you know, in preparation for any radio show, I try to read the books that a guest has written. And so I've been reading both your Fundamentals of Genocide and Mass Atrocity Prevention and the Making and Unmaking Nations, War, Leadership, and Genocide in Modern Africa. My family can tell you it's put me in a terrible mood. They're wonderful books, but I think there's something about trying to grasp the just overwhelming awfulness, the cruelty on a large scale, that makes it hard to go from that to just chatting about groceries or, yeah, you know, it just seems so unbearable.
Yeah, I think the hardest thing for me personally was, you know, when I, you know, the Making and Unmaking Nations book I worked on for 9 years, and, you know, the really difficult, and I've got young kids, and it was like always extremely jarring to, you know, to be sitting in my office all day trying to make sense of these episodes of war and violence, and then to go home and, you know, you walk in the door and you're immediately in kid land, and I often found that particularly jarring. It is discouraging, and it's hard. I mean, it puts me in bad moods too. I think what's kept me going is the sort of desire to know. Accidentally, as I just described, as a journalist, I came across this level of violence, and ever since, it's been very difficult to let go. I mean, it's a form of trauma, I think, that journalists sometimes experience, and I think soldiers and other people exposed to war sometimes experience. And in a way, I think of my work, both in the classroom and in my written work, as sort of a very, very long working through of, of this puzzle of how could this happen? And that sort of trying to address that puzzle is sort of what keeps me going. But it is hard. I mean, I don't want to make it about me, but it is certainly hard. I think these two books are sort of my coda. At least I intend them to be. You know, I've been working on this for some time, and it's also time for me to, you know, to move on to some other things. But
you do talk about how, though, it's not just that you're putting the facts or doing the research, but you've also kind of veered in both books in the direction of policy suggestions. Mm-hmm. So I would think, unlike some research that might just stay on a shelf, your books seem intended actually to maybe prophylactically look at what could be done worldwide to end this endless series of episodes of genocide.
Yeah, so they're, in a way, the two books are quite different. The Making and Unmaking Nations book is very much an academic book, and it's, I consider it my best work, my most mature work. It came out of my work on Rwanda, and this is sort of the book after the Rwanda research that I did in graduate school and subsequently. And you know, and that book, I think, puts research first, puts theory first, puts analysis first, and then it backs into a set of recommendations. The other book, which was published by the Holocaust Museum in D.C., was explicitly a, you know, policy-oriented, general audience book. And it's an interesting story of how that came about. And that's very explicitly a policy book. And what I would say is that, you know, I think in my field, I'm in a field that what we would call is very normative. You know, you're dealing with genocide. And as scholars, we try to approach things from a value-neutral point of view. We just try to understand them and explain them as best we can. The problem in my case is, you know, I'm dealing with something that's incredibly awful. And anyone who works on it, you know, obviously you have a position which is you don't want it to occur. And you feel some responsibility to, you know, to have practical implications to the work that you're doing. In my work, I've tried not to shy away from that, but while always seeing my role as being a scholar first. That is, I'm putting the analysis and the facts first and letting my analysis drive the answers. But to the extent that I can pull out policy claims or I can do some work that's relevant for policy, and I do a fair amount of it, I don't shy away from that. I think some scholars, sometimes want to put the policy first and their answers come from what's politically possible or policy possible. And I totally respect that, but that's not my position. Or they're just aimed at making it just pure research or basic research. And again, I feel a responsibility that my basic research should have implications and I don't shy away from them.
You sometimes see journalists struggling with that, too, where they're covering some terrible refugee crisis and there's dying babies right next to them as they're talking into a microphone. And you see them kind of wanting to reach and help someone who's just fainted or, you know, bring water to someone. And it's that struggle between telling a story, reporting objectively, and then actually becoming involved. One thing that you do in both books is spend some time on terminology. Mm-hmm. And I guess I had never thought about where did the term genocide first get used. And if you could talk about that, the term, what it means, and some of the other kind of related phrases that get tossed about.
Yeah, so the term genocide was coined by, you know, a very courageous, charismatic figure named Raphael Lemkin, who was a Polish Jewish guy, lost basically all his family in the Holocaust, a very accomplished legal scholar and prosecutor in Poland, and was driven out as the Nazis arrived in Poland in the late 1930s. And so he went on, eventually got, you know, became a refugee and ended up in the United States. And here he wrote a book documenting the Nazi crimes for the U.S. Army. And in that book, he coined the word genocide. And it combines the Greek word genos or genos, which refers to, you know, a people or a tribe or something along that, a group of people, you know, with side, which is the Latin for killing. And the idea is to, you know, destroy or kill a group of people. And that's what, you know, classically or etymologically, that's what genocide means. He then was one of the central drivers in lobbying for a United Nations Convention against genocide, and ultimately was successful. And there was a, you know, one of the, you know, the first human rights international treaty was the United Nations Convention on the Crime of Genocide. No, that's not the full title, but basically we typically people refer to it as just the Genocide Convention, which was put into practice in December 1948. And in there, it's a slightly different definition. It's the intent to destroy in whole or in part a racial, ethnic, national, or religious group. And then it lists a set of different acts. So that's the kind of the international legal definition is that. I think colloquially what we think of it as a systematic effort to destroy a group. In the Genocide Convention and in international law, it's slightly more broad than that. It's the intent to destroy in whole or in part a set of groups, four different types of groups. And so probably the issue that's received the most attention as people analyze the convention and its problems has been that the idea of political groups is not included in the legal definition of genocide. And really that had to do with Soviet objections to the inclusion of political groups. So the Soviet Union was the Permanent Council as a permanent five member of the UN Security Council, and it essentially objected to political groups being included because of the actions that it had taken and was going to take could be construed as genocide, and it didn't want to agree to that. Anyway, that was, you know, a bit more long-winded, but anyway, that's the legal definition.
Besides the Holocaust in Nazi Germany, which mm-hmm. obviously fits the definition of genocide, where you have the systematic, widespread, calculated killing of Jews, what other episodes outside of Africa mm-hmm. would fit the definition of genocide?
Okay. So people typically talk about – so outside of Africa, people typically talk about the Armenian genocide in 1915, where you had the Ottoman government, now Turkey, that basically systematically destroyed the Armenian minority Christian population in the eastern parts of the Ottoman Empire during World War I. And that was through a combination of massacres and forced deportation. Essentially, you know, around a million people were forced out of their homes. Then they were chased and killed and raped along the way, and then ended up in deserts where they couldn't survive. You have sort of now post-World War II, you a bunch of different cases. Again, it depends a little bit on how you categorize it. One of the ones that's received a fair amount of attention recently is Indonesia in 1965, where you had a government that essentially massacred large numbers of Chinese, ethnic Chinese, and also people who were in the Communist Party. That's another case. You have, I'm trying to think about outside of Africa, Burundi in 1972, that's inside of Africa. You have Bangladesh and the violence as Bangladesh became independent. You have also the experience of the Soviet Union and the violence against the so-called kulaks. These would be people that were declared as middle class people inside the Soviet Union, declared as enemies of the revolution, where there was systematic violence against them. You have also the Chinese experiences, both the Great Famine and also the Cultural Revolution. And here's where you sort of the definitional problems start to, you know, get in. There's much more. There's some controversy as to whether or not one wants to call those just crimes against humanity or genocide or, you know, horrible instances of violence, and, you know, whether or not these labels even matter. And perhaps we can talk about that. But, you know, huge numbers of people lost their lives in those episodes. You also, in more contemporary times, you have Bosnia in the 1990s, the early 1990s, which on a couple of different occasions, different international courts have concluded that the violence in Bosnia was genocide. I'm sure I'm forgetting some other ones. I should have reviewed a list before I came. But anyway, those are some of the examples that people think about. Yeah.
Would it be fair to go way back and call the massacre of Native Americans genocide?
Yeah, so the case against Native Americans is, I mean, definitely in some cases. I think, you know, we have to think about the American Indian case. I think in both in terms of time and in terms of variation against groups. So one of the core elements of genocide is the idea that it's a deliberate or intentional. It's the intent to destroy a group. And the question often with a lot of the experience of American Indians was, you know, was there an intent to destroy those groups? Or did they die in large numbers because of famine, because of disease, and so forth? Now, sometimes the disease was intentionally transmitted, and it was transmitted in a way that was designed to weaken, destroy these communities. Other times it was not necessarily intended to be the case. Then we get into the question of whether or not the kind of overall vulnerability of American Indians made those communities, because of the movement of settlers and the occupation of space by, you know, incoming Europeans, made them incredibly vulnerable to disease and to famine in ways that wouldn't have happened. So even if the intent was not necessarily in spreading disease, was not necessarily there, the effect of their dislocation and dispossession was to end up in with an experience like genocide. Now there are other cases where, I mean, again, we're talking about a long period of time, a 400-year period of time. There are other cases where, you know, in California or some of the, you know, the ones that the scholarship points to, where it was clear, like it was a gold rush. There were American Indian groups there. You know, the gold rushers and the settlers just wanted to destroy them, and it's clear, and the language is clear, and so forth. You know, the Trail of Tears. You know, here, you know, you get into this distinction between whether or not the actual forced removal of a group was designed to destroy that group, or whether or not it was designed to be forced removal and they could survive in some other location. And again, you start to get into semantics, which I think can be unproductive sometimes. I think, you know, what I would say overall is clearly in the United States, we have both with the experience of slavery and with the experience of American Indians, you know, big episodes of mass violence. And, you know, overall, when we look, you know, at contemporary situations, we say, you know, there should be an importance for accountability, you know, for a truth commission, sometimes some type of public accounting for that kind of violence. And, you know, broadly speaking, I think that has not happened in the United States. And so whether we call it genocide, whether we call it crimes against humanity, whether we call it ethnic cleansing, these are some of the kind of cognate terms. I think clearly there was an experience of deliberate violence and dispossession that needs to be reckoned with.
Do you think that racism comes into play when we're talking about genocide in Africa, that if the same numbers of civilians killed in places like Rwanda were being killed in Norway, mm-hmm. that we might view it differently? And when do you find when you're talking about your work in the countries you've visited in Africa and that you've studied, that some people have a kind of almost distance from it or have become numb?
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, I'd say students are not that way. I think in my experience teaching here for the last 12 years, I think students are very, very open to learning. And oftentimes with regard to the Africa cases, they just haven't been exposed to it. And, you know, in high school or previously or through various forms of media. And they're eager. They want to learn. And I think having that lack of knowledge and having not just heard that much about it, they're just surprised that they didn't know these things had happened.
But isn't that part of the problem, too? Because I know, you know, one of my former Odyssey students sent me a message about her native Sudan and, you know, the outbreak of war. And I looked to try to find it in the news. And it wasn't that easy to find news stories because we're busy covering, you know, an election or the Olympics or whatever. And a lot of these stories kind of get buried.
No, I mean, you're right. You know, I'm not necessarily defending it. I mean, I think from the editor's point of view, just because I used to sit in this position, you know, they feel like people don't care that much about Africa and they don't know that much. And so they, you know, maybe there's one big story here and there, but they don't want the detailed ins and outs kind of in the way that we would cover, you know, a France or a China or whatever. But in general, I'd say, you know, the American media appetite for international news is low. And within that, Africa's always at the bottom. So, you've huge headwinds trying to overcome both of those problems. I think the newspapers and radio programs have been cutting international coverage. And often the first thing to go, is Africa. Then when you do get coverage of Africa, it's very simplistic. It's ahistorical. It's often mediated, it's told, it's narrated through the experience of tribe and through ethnicity. And you just don't get any of the complexity or any of the understanding or richness of what's really going on. Is that racism? Some of it is racism, probably. I don't know. Some of it is just lack of experience. I think the United States has the slave past, but it doesn't have the colonial past that a lot of the European countries have. So when you go to Britain or you go to France or you go to Portugal, there's actually much more deep knowledge of Africa in those countries because of the colonial experience. So I think that's an element. But I would say, and this wasn't exactly your question, but, I would turn it this way. From a policy point of view, I think that here we see the Africa stuff showing up a lot. And what I mean by that is that, if you want to get traction on these cases and try to turn the violence around, it requires, blood and treasure. It requires putting people at risk and spending money and having skin in the game. And it's a lot easier for, American politicians to have skin in the game when they don't have to make the argument like that this matters, this place matters, right? Because the presumption is when you're dealing with Africa that it doesn't matter to the national security interests or the national economic interests of the United States. So the idea that the United States would have skin in the game, put blood and treasure on the line, for a place like Rwanda that no one had heard of, no one had been to, is unfathomable. We look now at the genocide in Rwanda and we say, this was a preventable case. Half a million civilians killed in 3 months at least. And why did we turn our backs? That's the right moral question. But when you look at it from a political point of view, it was obvious. It was very obvious, particularly in the wake of what happened in Somalia. And so anyway, that's a long-winded answer. Some of that's racism, but I think it's a little more complicated than racism alone.
You mentioned that we don't know that much about Africa, and we're going to try to fix some of that coming up next on University of the Year.
Genocide and similar forms of mass violence are among the most devastating of all human phenomena. Genocide extinguishes masses of lives. It scars societies and families for generations. No society should ever experience it. Genocide is also the ultimate failure in politics. Genocide reflects a decision to reject accommodation, to inflict maximum violence, and to extinguish future social interaction in a shared territory. Rather than manage a social contract, negotiate difference, devolve power, distribute goods, and compromise through accommodation or negotiation, the promise of politics, however flawed in all its myriad applications and however constrained by limited means, genocide is about destroying human populations so they can and will not make demands or pose threats.
That's from the opening of the book, Making and Unmaking Nations, War Leadership and Genocide in Modern Africa, by my guest, Scott Strauss. We are talking about preventing genocide. You've defined it in that paragraph very succinctly. And now let's turn to the place you've studied the most, which is Rwanda. And if you could help us understand, why did it happen there? Who were the perpetrators? Why was it not stopped? And what about it made it sort of this classic case of genocide?
Okay. So Rwanda's in Central Africa. It's a population. So the genocide happened in 1994. Then it was about a population of about 7.5 million. And in the genocide period, you know, between 500,000 and 800,000 civilians were killed. The primary victims were the Tutsi minority, Tutsi civilians. There are three major ethnic groups in Rwanda. They're the Tutsi, who were about, you know, 10% to 14% of the population in Rwanda at the time. There were the Hutu, the majority, who were between, you know, 85%, 86%, and 90% of the population. And there were the Twa, a small group, about 1% of the population. And so the primary victims were Tutsis. The primary perpetrators were Hutus. But, you know, I think it's often important to not to generalize. It was not the entire Hutu population. It was, you know, a particular set of people that committed. It wasn't, you know, the Hutus against the Tutsis. That's true in the sense that most of the perpetrators were Hutus and most of the victims were Tutsis. But it's not as if it was one whole ethnic group against another whole ethnic group.
What were the key differences between those groups? Was it religious? Was it why would there be hatred?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. It's a surprisingly complicated to answer. So, I mean, it's, you know, Hutu and Tutsi speak the same language. Prior to the genocide, they intermarried. They're in the same clans. They live in the same region. They more or less have the same culture and so forth. So, you know, in academic terms, we would refer to this as an ethnic difference, as ethnicity, about different imaginations of who the groups are. But in practical terms, it's not a religious difference. It's not a language difference. It's not a clan difference. It's not a regional difference. It's a very unusual intermixing of populations. So the story here is that, and I sort of have to go back to, you know, history a little bit. The story here is that in this part of Africa, you had a very sophisticated political system before colonialism, one of the more sophisticated indigenous African political systems on the continent, or at least in sub-Saharan Africa. It was a monarchy. You had a kingship. And it was a very hierarchical system in which the elites in that system were known as Tutsis, and they were primarily involved in animal husbandry, in cattle rearing in particular. So the distinction historically was about status, about who was an elite or who had more status in that society, and about economic activity in the sense that Tutsis were elites or had higher status, and Tutsis were primarily involved in animal husbandry. By contrast, you had Hutus, or what people known as Hutu. They were laborers, they were people involved in agriculture, and people with lower status. And the king was Tutsi. The people around the court were Tutsi, again, higher status. But a Hutu could become Tutsi if he or she gained enough status to become into that sort of higher echelon of people. Now, when colonialism or when the Europeans started to arrive in the mid-19th century and they were looking in this area of Africa for the headquarters of the Nile, the headwaters of the Nile River, which are in this area, and they were both the kind of explorers, they were missionaries, and ultimately European colonial states. So Rwanda was first colonized by Germany, and then it was colonized by Belgium. And when they found this both a sophisticated kingdom in Rwanda and in some neighboring areas, and they found this hierarchical differentiation, they immediately concluded that the distinction was about race, that what they were observing was the presence of a superior race, Tutsis, who had control over an inferior race, Hutus. And they thought of the Hutus, they labeled the Hutus as Bantus and called them Negroids and basically said these are the true Africans. And Tutsis they called Hamites and called them Caucasoid or white-like, and argued that this white-like, sophisticated, higher status group actually came from the Middle East. They actually were not African, or at least they came from North Africa. It depended on who was writing. And so they used the racial, quote-unquote, science of the day which held that there was a hierarchy of races, and they imputed that hierarchy or imposed that hierarchy on what they found in Rwanda. And so the colonial system was built upon this racial categorization of Tutsis as being this higher race, this minority that was superior, more sophisticated, more elegant. You know, they measured their noses, they measured their height, they measured their skin color, all this racial stuff that went into it at the time. And then in the colonial system gave all the power to Tutsis in terms of education, in terms of the church, which was very powerful, in terms of the colonial administration, in terms of business, I mean, all of it. And so even though there had been a monarchy that was based on hierarchy previously, that the differences between these groups was exacerbated, was racialized, and was institutionalized under the colonial system from the late 19th century, basically through the mid-1950s. Okay, and what happened then is the Hutu, who had been systematically discriminated against in the colonial system and treated as inferior, but who were the majority. As Africa began to turn, that is, as the colonial moment ended, and after World War II, and you have all these domestic movements for independence and for change, the Hutu who were in the country began to make an argument that freedom and independence and democracy, which is what the language of ending colonialism was about, meant independence not only from Belgian rule at that time, but also it meant rule by the majority, or in this case, rule by Hutus. And so their movement for independence, the Hutu movement for independence, became about not only getting rid of the Belgians, but also about overturning this hierarchy, this ethnic hierarchy that was in place at the time and under colonialism. And so they argued Hutu, independence, democracy means Hutu rule. It means no longer having systematic discrimination against Hutus. And for a complex set of reasons, ultimately this gave birth to what's known as the Hutu Revolution in Rwanda in the late 1950s and early 1960s, where the Tutsi monarchy was abolished, the Tutsi power structure was overthrown, and you had a reversal where Hutus came to power, and then they systematically excluded Tutsis. Mm-hmm. And this kind of what I call language of Hutu nationalism, of Hutu majoritarian rule, then became the excuse for discriminating against Tutsis. Tutsis are then on the outside. You've got kind of 30 years of Hutu-dominated rule. And eventually what happened is that many of the children of Tutsis who had fled Rwanda during the revolution and also subsequent periods of violence eventually formed a rebel army, an insurgency in the early 1990s, and they invaded Rwanda starting in 1990. And then you had basically a civil war between these sort of Tutsi exiles on the one hand and the Hutu-led government on the other. And that mix, both of the sort of, I argue, the sort of ideology of nationalism, of Hutu nationalism, which stayed throughout in Rwanda, and the fact of a military threat from this minority group were basically the two major ingredients, two of the three major ingredients of why that genocide took place.
That was a lot more complicated than in my head it was. I mean, I think it's fascinating to then look at where blame lies, because you can see how even the colonial intervention created, a cauldron. So then where does the genocide sort of begin and end in Rwanda?
Yeah, absolutely. So the genocide begins basically April 6th of 1994. And what had happened, and it ends, basically early, mid-July. I think technically it's July 14th of 1994. And so what happened is that there had been, so there was the civil war, as I just described. There was a peace agreement that was signed in 1993, and as part of that peace agreement, there was an agreement to share power. There was an international peacekeeping operation that was launched for Rwanda, led by, which I'll come back to in a minute, led by a very passionate and charismatic Canadian general named Roméo Dallaire. They were deployed to Rwanda to kind of keep the peace and to ensure a transition. But on April 6th of 1994, the president of Rwanda, a Hutu guy named Juvenal Habyarimana, his plane was shot down. And as soon as his plane was shot down, the sort of hardcore, hardline extremist elements inside his government took power. And what they basically the genocide became their policy. It became their policy to defeat the enemy, which they labeled as the military enemy was these Tutsi rebels, but they said that their enemy was the Tutsi population, and they in turn, organized a whole operation inside of Rwanda to systematically destroy all the Tutsi civilians of the country. And what's shocking about Rwanda is that it's a small country. It's extremely well organized. I mean, it always has been, even since the pre-colonial period, very dense state administration. And once that those extremists were able to secure control inside of Rwanda, they were able to, organize this through the state, through the government, relatively quickly and very effectively, such that, even by the end of the first month, by the end of April, you had, 60 to 70% of the Tutsi population was already killed, within 4 weeks.
Using what rhetoric to justify it? In other words, because you look at Nazi Germany and there was a lot of use of propaganda and demagogues and, there was language that justified it. What about in the case of Rwanda?
Yeah, so you had the language stuff, you had radio. I mean, my research basically showed that it was through face-to-face mobilization. And the language, the primary language was war. It was a war. We are under threat. They've killed our president. We have to defend ourselves. We need every able-bodied man and every able-bodied person to contribute to this effort. And the war, the way the war was described was as going out and destroying the Tutsi enemy. And what that meant in practice was finding every Tutsi civilian, every baby, every woman, every elder, every man, everybody. And they organized it through what were called night patrols, where they would essentially organized it through a self defense mechanism, where they would round up usually men in the neighborhood and the community. They would basically conscript them into service, and then their purpose of their service was to go out and find Tutsis and kill them. The rhetoric was primarily about war. There are also tons of dehumanization rhetoric that both over the radio, and in this process, where Tutsis were called snakes, they were called cockroaches, they were, called all kinds of things. But those in particular were some of the tropes that were used. But really, I think, in my research, my first book on Rwanda, I spent 6 months in the prisons interviewing perpetrators, and a lot of the rhetoric was really about war, and it was really about the language of killing enemies, of destroying enemies, and about fear, about mobilizing fear, and sort of saying if we don't get them first, they're going to get us, and so I think that was a lot of it.
And if you look at why there wasn't more of an international effort to stop it, is it, how much of that is sort of worrying that you're going to have a mess, as in the sort of Black Hawk Down kind of experience, or that this is some other country's problem, we're going to intervene and we don't even know what we're doing? If you look at why was it not stopped?
I think both of those things were a factor. I mean, I think there are a bunch of things that were going on. So, number one, this was, 9 months after the Black Hawk Down incident in Somalia. And I think, if there's a number one issue that went on, it was Somalia. Right, that Somalia cast a long shadow over Rwanda. And, for those who don't remember, what happened in Somalia was there was this big intervention, American-led, but also involving the United Nations, to stop this famine. And it was stopped for a while. It's when there tried to be a political solution and impose a political solution in Somalia that there was this more direct confrontation with the American forces and the UN forces, which ultimately led to the Black Hawk Down incident, in which a lot of Somalis and a number of American servicemen were killed. And I think, for the Clinton administration at the time, I just think it was a no-brainer. It was like, we're not going to get involved in Africa. We're not going to take that risk. And the instinct, not only for the U.S., but for a number of other countries and the United Nations bureaucracy, was get out. We're not going to to put our peacekeepers at risk. And so I think that's number one. That what can also contributed that to that was that on the, you know, basically the first day, or April 7th, April 8th, the core, sort of the best trained and best armed peacekeepers in the UN mission in Rwanda were the Belgians. And there were 10 Belgian peacekeepers that were killed by these extremist forces in the early days. And that just kind of fed this sense within, you know, among the internationals, like, we need to get out. And that's what they did. You know, and it wasn't much of a conversation. Now, as a background to that, I think one has to recognize that, you know, Rwanda didn't have strategic importance from a national security point of view. It did not have
no oil.
No oil, no economic. It wasn't a major trading partner. It wasn't, you know, wasn't a coastal area. There was no naval base there. I mean, you know, whatever it is that you want to cite, it was a country no one had heard of. It was French speaking. You know, there were at the time, you know, very few experts, very few advocates, very few people had been there. It was totally, you know, all people could talk about was ancient tribal hatred. And, you know, there was no, you know, the people that the policymakers interviewed afterwards, you know, their line, which I think is totally appropriate, was no one was calling us. You know, our phones were not ringing off the hooks. No one seemed to care. How can you expect us to get out there in front of this issue when no one seems to care? And so I think that's another factor. I think one also has to take into account the speed. It happened fast, really fast. And even though there were warnings, and in hindsight we can say, yes, you know, we should have known. There were some assessments, some intelligence assessments, this, that, and the other thing. There were warnings. Yeah, I agree with all of that. But once it started, it happened very, very quickly. And that doesn't defend how it was handled, but that was a constraint on what the margin for maneuver was. My bottom line is that, you know, and having thought about this and studied it carefully, I think it would have been impossible to save all of the lives, given how fast it was, given the situation. But I think a relatively modest intervention probably would have saved around half of the lives. I mean, I can't say that precisely, but that's my general sense of it. And the way it would have worked is that instead of withdrawing, if the UN peacekeeping mission had been, you know, had been reinforced, which is what the force commander, General Dallaire, wanted, I think it would have turned some of the dynamics in the country, because there were a lot of Hutus that didn't want to commit the violence, and they were ultimately overwhelmed by the extremists. And the violence was much slower in areas where Tutsis were concentrated. So if you, even though if the first 2 weeks had passed, if there would have been a more modest intervention or creation of a buffer zone or something, we could talk about exactly what, I still think you would have been talking about saving 200,000 to 400,000 lives, which is a lot of lives. Honestly. Yeah. But I don't think the whole thing could have been stopped.
You know, we say never again after the Holocaust, but it seems there's always an again and again. We're going to talk about preventing genocide going forward when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Preventing genocide is an achievable goal. It is an achievable goal, but it is one that does not start from the top, it starts from the bottom up. It's remarkable as we walked through this exhibit, Ellie and I were talking as we looked at the unhappy record of the State Department and so many officials here in the United States during those years. And he asked, what would you do? But what you all understand is you don't just count on officials. You don't just count on governments. You count on people and mobilizing their consciences.
That's from President Obama's remarks at the Holocaust Memorial Museum. after creating the Atrocity Prevention Board in 2012. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Scott Straus, and we are talking about preventing genocide. Can you talk a little bit, because your most recent book, Fundamentals of Genocide and Mass Atrocity Prevention, is in fact published by the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, where President Obama was speaking. Can you talk to us about how that came about?
Absolutely. So essentially, President Obama stood up a interagency board to prioritize atrocity prevention, genocide and atrocity prevention in the United States. And one of the mandates of that board has been, you know, there has to be general training of U.S. government officials across different agencies on atrocity prevention. Sort of, how do you recognize it? What causes it? What is it? How do you prevent it? What are the tools? And so forth. And those folks reached out to the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, which has an education mission. And they basically said, look, we have stuff for the Holocaust, but we don't have stuff for the contemporary world. And so the museum then in turn reached out to me and said, can you help us with this? And so one thing led to another. We organized a big seminar in D.C. and had a bunch of policymakers there. And the reality was that there wasn't really anything off the shelf that we could use. And so I proposed to them that that we create something. And so we worked together, the museum and I worked together for about 2.5 years to produce this book. It's designed, you can buy it at Amazon, but it's also freely downloadable. It's designed as a book that not only for policymakers, but I think for a general audience, people who want to quickly get up to speed on what is genocide, what are mass atrocities, how do you know it when you see it, what causes them, what do you do to stop it, what do we know about what works and doesn't work about how to stop it. It's designed as sort of a one-stop-shop book that really synthesizes a field. And so it's more like a textbook. It's not written like a textbook, but it's designed as something that assumes no prior knowledge, and that's how it came about. And so it was this partnership with the museum over the last couple of years.
You spend quite a bit of time in the book talking about triggers for genocide and, you know, how do you see that a country is ripe for genocide to take place, and then some various suggestions as to what would be a appropriate intervention. Can you talk about that? Like, let's say you're looking around the globe right now, mm-hmm. and you're going to be looking to see where is genocide likely to take place. What sorts of things do you look for?
So typically you look for some type of major instability. So, major political crisis, some type of regime change. I think that coupled with and especially the presence of war, the presence of some type of military, significant military threat. Typically in the contemporary world, it's going to be a civil war threat, but it could also be an interstate war kind of threat. And I think it's those are two of the ingredients. So the other thing that one would see is a lot of polarization within a population, where the rhetoric is sort of, leading to intense dehumanization of both sides, in a military conflict.
You mean like where there's an other, whether it's Muslims or a different race or a different something?
Yep, or ethnic group or religious mm-hmm. group, exactly. And so, where elites, where leaders are wrapping up the military threat and using the language of the military threat, but referring to it as an ethnic group or a religious group or a particular people. It's the Sunnis that are doing this. And you start to see the Sunnis, if you're talking about Iraq, the Sunnis and Shias, separating, physically separating, and that language heating up. I think also there has to be some type of grounding ideology, some type of, organizing ideology which is going to support or justify any type of large-scale organized violence against a civilian population that's going to ultimately, again, interact with this military threat. So it's polarization, and then there's usually some shock to the system, an assassination, a change in battlefield dynamics, some type of major economic crash, something that's going to spark it and set it going that is what we look for. But it's not an exact science. A lot of these cases are different. And I also make the argument in the book, we need a kind of case-by-case assessment of different situations.
So let's say a place like that is identified. The United Nations knows it. Everybody sees that there's this eruption about to happen. Then what?
Yeah. So first of all, to answer that question, I want to make the point that you know, Rwanda, Bosnia, the mid-1990s were really a kind of low point in, you know, the never again stuff. I mean, you know, it was, you know, it was after the Cold War. There was a real hope that, that after the Cold War, there could be a, you know, renewed sense of human rights protections. Then you get Rwanda, you get Bosnia. These horrible massacres happen. The world stands by. But since then, I think there has been a major kind of reflection and effort for it to be better than it was in the mid-1990s. And that's been reflected both in the United States in terms of this, you know, atrocity prevention war, but also things that happened under President Bush. Also at the United Nations, they, you know, stood up a, you know, UN special advisor office on genocide prevention. And in terms of different policy doctrines and policy frameworks, both within the United Nations system and also within the United States. And so I think, you know, the bottom line is I think both from a normative point of view, meaning like, you know, the idea that it's been clearly articulated that this is not okay. And I think because of the publicity of the horrendous violence in Rwanda and Bosnia, and there's much more widespread recognition of this as a problem. So both from a kind of norm or moral point of view, from an actual concrete policy framework, like what can you do, and from the actual tools, like here are the different options one has at one's disposal. So I think there has been, you know, Rwanda was a low point. Bosnia was a low point. There's been a lot of improvement since then on the policy side that I think a lot of people aren't aware of. And when we look at the violence in Syria or wherever, it's incredibly easy to feel very discouraged. But I think there has been very significant improvement over the last 15, 20 years that I think is important, you know, for me and also, you know, listeners to recognize. Now, to get to your question, what do you do? So I think, you know, the policymaker looking at the situation has a series of tools at his or her disposal. Some of them are going to be diplomatic. So they're going to be and kind of information based. So they're going to be like you send over the assistant secretary of state, or you send over a high ranking diplomat, or you form a regional team of leaders, and you go to that country and you say, hey, we're watching you. You can't do this. We have all these doctrines. We have all these tools at our disposal. If you go down this path, you're going to face the consequences. So, you know, that's sort of an implied threat. Then, you know, that doesn't work. There's also like the sort of documentation and legal preparation. So meaning, you know, victims are interviewed. There's a sort of documentation and publicizing of the atrocities as they're occurring. That can be at the UN level. It can be a commission of inquiry. It can be a type of report. It can be a US product. That in itself can be an effort to kind of shame people, but that can also directly lead to a legal case, some type of international criminal prosecution. The main mechanism today is the International Criminal Court. There are also a bunch of economic different things that can be done and different kinds of sanctions, whether they are targeted sanctions, freezing of bank accounts, trade sanctions. And then there are various military options. So there can be, you know, creation of a safe haven, a no-fly zone. There can be interruption of military communication. There are a variety of things. It's not all regime change. I think in the Rwanda days, the Somalia days, in the 1990s, it was sort of like we have two options. We can do nothing, or we can go in and overthrow government. Okay. Since Iraq, you know, the idea of going in and it, you know, shouldn't be, you know, we should have known better, but going in and overthrowing government, it's a very problematic position to take, even if it's for atrocity prevention. And so I think what we've seen over the last 10 years is to sort of think about these other options which can have a difference or theoretically can have make a difference, but are not regime change. They're not doing nothing and they're not regime change.
Thank you for what I see as very important work that you're doing in getting the word out about preventing genocide. My guest has been Scott Strauss. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air.